Certainly a blessing to be here. Great to have everybody who is here. We have a good number. We really do. And this is encouraging. I want to preach to you a lesson that I've already preached here once. I've only been here a year and a half. I preached this actually in the gospel meeting that I held before I actually started preaching here. So some of you may not have been here for that night. I can't remember which evening it was during the meeting that I preached this lesson, but I thought it would be a timely lesson because in the adult class, you all just wrapped up the three cycles. So I'm going to just kind of put it all together today in a lesson. If somebody could, I'm going to have a lot of slides. I was hoping Scott would still be standing in the back, but he went and sat down. Get 21 and 22, those two switches for me. Today I'm going to use a lot more slides than normal, and I would like them to show up a little bit more clearly. Our PowerPoint's not quite bright enough for this particular lesson. The Bible is an amazing book. It's actually not one book. It's a library of books. And there are 66 books or letters within this one book. And the Bible was not written by one man who just sat down and decided, well, it'd be a good idea to write one flowing story here. No, it was written by about 40 men over a period of about 1,500 years. The first writer of a Bible book, the one who wrote the first five books of the Bible, was Moses. So we go back to 1,400 BC to Moses, and the New Testament was finished being written within the first century. So that's about 1,500 years from 1,400 BC to the end of the first century AD. And these writers were separated not only by time but also by space. They were writing in different languages. The Bible is mainly written in two languages. Part of the Old Testament is written in Aramaic, but most of it's written in Hebrew. The New Testament is written in Greek. Yet with all these varying factors, what's so amazing is that there is one theme in the Bible. And I think this is a great evidence that the Bible is from God. You know, you can't get two people in Washington to agree on anything. And we are especially aware of that with what's going on right now and everything. But here you have these 40 men separated by time and space, and they didn't know what the next person was going to be writing and everything, but yet these books are collated together, and what do we have? We have one flowing unity. And really there's a narrative throughout the Bible that connects it all together beautifully. And the theme is God's plan for the salvation of mankind. So we're going to take a look today at the Bible story, the Bible flow, the plot of the Bible, a survey of God's unfolding plan for man's redemption. And why do I want to do this? Well, I want us to stand in awe of the mind of God. I want us to stand in awe of the Word of God. And I want to build your faith. That's why I want to preach this. So, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's easy to say. But imagine the power that that must take to speak everything that exists into existence. You know, sometimes we might feel slighted. Well, I don't get to see miracles like people in the Bible got to see. The age of miracles is over. Well, that's true. But every day we do get to see the product of one of the greatest miracles ever done. The biggest miracle, no doubt. The creation of the universe. Every day when we go out, we get to see the results of that marvelous miracle. That's faith building. So, Adam and Eve were placed in the Garden of Eden. And there was a river that ran through the garden. There was a tree in the middle of the garden. The tree of life. Well, I'm sorry. The tree in the middle of the garden was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But there was the tree of life also. And there was no pain, there was no harm, there was no fear, there was no sin. This was paradise. They had everything that they could ever need. But Satan made them think they needed more. Because he appeared to the woman and he said, "Has God told you that you cannot eat from the trees in the garden?" "Oh yes, we can eat from the trees in the garden, but the tree in the middle of the garden, God has said, do not eat from it. Don't even touch it. In the day that you do, you will surely die." "You will not surely die. God knows that in the day you eat of it, you will be like Him, knowing good and evil." So we see Satan's nature from the very beginning. He's a deceiver. He's the father of lies. And he's a slanderer. And here he is accusing God of lying. And she believed it. And so she looked at that fruit. We don't know if it was an apple, what fruit it was. But whatever fruit it was, it looked good to her eye. And she thought it would taste good. And she wanted to be wise like God. So she took it and she ate. And that was the first sin that humanity committed. She gave the fruit to Adam and he ate. And then they were suddenly ashamed that they didn't have any clothes on. They'd never been ashamed about that before. I don't even know if they ever noticed it before. So they went and hid themselves because God was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. Imagine the walks that must have taken place before that. But this time they were hiding. And God said to the man, "Where were you?" "Well, I was hiding because I was afraid, because I was naked." "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of that tree which I told you not to eat?" And he said, "It was the woman's fault." And the woman said, "It was the serpent's fault." And nobody took the blame. Not much has changed throughout human history. So God had some things to say to Adam and Eve, like pain and childbirth. He told Adam that dust you are and to dust you shall return. In other words, death is now going to be a reality. We talk about death being a natural process of life. And there's a sense, I guess, in which you could say that. But there's another very real sense in which death is not natural at all. It's very unnatural. Because man was not created to die. Adam and Eve were created to live forever. And they could have done that. But they chose to sin and to ruin that. And so now death is part of this fallen world. We live in a creation that has been subjected to futility. And death is a constant, painful, unnatural reminder that we don't live in paradise. Well, God, before he said those things to Adam and Eve, he also had something unpleasant to tell the serpent. And in Genesis 3 and verse 15, he said, "And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed, he, that is the seed of woman, shall crush your head, and you will crush his heel." So, there is going to be a human being, someone born of woman, and this one would be uniquely born of woman, as we will later see, who would deal a crushing blow to Satan's head. This is symbolic of what would happen later with Jesus Christ. And really, Genesis 3:15, you could say, is the thesis statement for the whole Bible. The rest of the Bible is going to tell us how that one verse comes true. And it was written by Moses 1,500 years or 1,400 years before Christ. Amazing. Amazing. So Adam and Eve were banished from the garden. And we're going to see the generations go all the way from Eve down to that seed of woman who would crush Satan's head. So Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, Noah. We get to Noah. Noah was a righteous man. He was a preacher of righteousness, Peter tells us in the New Testament. He was righteous in all his generations, and Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. But the rest of the world did not, because every thought of their heart was only evil continually, and God repented that he had made man. And he decided that he was going to kill everything that breathes. But he was going to spare Noah and Noah's three sons and their three wives and Noah's wife, so there would be eight people saved. He told Noah to build a box. Now, that's what an ark is. It was a big rectangular box about a football field and a half long. It wasn't a boat. It didn't have a rudder and so on. It was just meant to float until the water stopped being on the face of the earth. So he builds this ark. And this takes many years. I think that's what the 120 years refers to. Until the time that the waters came, there would be 120 years would be the days of man. And the rains came, and the fountains of the great deep burst forth. It was violent. And it rained for 40 days nonstop. And they were in the ark, Noah and his family, and two of every kind of animal, seven of every clean animal. for a year and 10 days until the water had finally receded and Noah and his family came out of the ark. His descendants gradually migrated down from Mount Ararat, where the ark rested, which is in modern-day Turkey. They gradually migrated down between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in a plain called Shinar. And it is there where they built this city, and they were building a tower. And it actually says they built the tower. I don't get the idea that they finished it. But they were building this tower with the idea of getting up high in the sky with this tower to make a name for themselves. Not, well, I want to get up to where God is. Now, I hope that we don't teach children that. You know, they were trying to build the tower to get up. They were trying to get up to God. No, that is not what the Bible teaches. They were building it high in the heavens, like Mr. Waldron says, like a skyscraper, just to make a name for themselves. And they had one language. They were one nation. Well, God had told Noah. He had told Adam, multiply and fill the earth. This was not God's plan. So God divided their languages, and the people scattered and spread into three distinct areas. And we are mainly going to follow the descendants of Shem, because that's where the one who would later crush Satan's head would come from. So Shem, Arphaxad, Shelah, Eber, Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, Terah, Abram. We get to Abram. We call him Abraham, which he was called much later in life. God appeared to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 and said, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to a land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who curse you. I will bless those who bless you. And the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And so he went. He departed, going to a land he had never known. And in Genesis 12 and verse 7, the Lord said to him, to your descendants, I will give this land. So we have the threefold promise given to Abraham in order. You actually had the nation promise first, the spiritual promise second, that all the world would be blessed through the seed of Abraham. And then thirdly, the land promise given in verse 7. That's the actual order they are given to Abraham. So we can say land, nation, spiritual. That's the order we're used to, or land, nation, seed. But the actual order is nation, spiritual, land that they were given to Abraham. These same three promises were given to Abraham's son Isaac and to Isaac's son Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons. And Jacob's favorite son was Joseph. Everybody knows the story about Joseph and the multicolored coat. And he was his daddy's favorite. He had the special coat. Joseph had dreams that God gave him, these dreams that his brothers, even his parents, would one day bow down before him. And his brothers were very jealous, and they didn't like these dreams. So they saw him coming one day to check on them, and they said, here comes that dreamer. Let's kill him. That was their original plan, though one of the brothers changed their minds, and they decided not to kill him, but to sell him. So they sold him as a slave to Ishmaelite traders who were going down to Egypt. So now Joseph is sold to these traders, and they want to make a profit with him. So they take him down, and they bring him down to Egypt and sell him, no doubt, for a profit. Potiphar worked for the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he was the bodyguard. Potiphar was the bodyguard, captain of the bodyguard, rather, for Pharaoh. And so Joseph went to work for Pharaoh and was successful, and everything seemed to be going well until Potiphar's own wife lied about Joseph, said that he basically tried to rape her, and so Potiphar threw Joseph in prison, and eventually, at least 2 years later, Joseph is released from prison because he interpreted two dreams that the Pharaoh had. And these two dreams, the interpretation of these two dreams was that they're are going to be 7 years of plenty in the land. A lot of rain and growth. And then following those 7 years of plenty, there are going to be 7 years of famine, and the famine will be so severe that it'll be like the 7 years of plenty never even happened. And so, once the 7 years, oh, and I forgot to say, once Joseph told the king that, he said, well, let's put you in charge of this. And he put him in second in power in all of Egypt. And so when the 7 years of plenty came and went and the 7 years of famine began, then anybody who needed grain, where did they go? Well, they went to Egypt to get the grain, even Joseph's own brothers. And so they went, and they didn't recognize Joseph, but he recognized them. And through a process of events, he eventually reveals himself to them. He forgives them. And can you imagine forgiving somebody who had done that to you? He said, "You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." And then he moved his whole family down to Egypt, to Goshen. And there they lived and multiplied. The Israelites multiplied as a separate and distinct nation because the Egyptians wouldn't even eat with them. That's one of the amazing things in the plan of God here, that they would be a separate and distinct nation as they grew and developed during that formative time, going from 75 people to millions. And so for these next four centuries, they are there in Egypt, multiplying and multiplying until they are so great in number that the Pharaoh in that day is afraid of them. And so he decides to make them slaves, and it is bitter bondage. He is so paranoid that he decides to have all of the male Hebrew or Jewish babies put to death. They will be thrown into the Nile River because it would be the baby boys who could one day become soldiers. So there was one mother who was not willing to let this happen. I'm sure many mothers weren't willing to let it happen, but she saw to it that it wouldn't happen. And she hid her child until she couldn't hide him anymore. And then she made a basket that he could float in, and she put him in the Nile River. And it wasn't just one of these things, you know, good luck, as he floats down this river with alligators in it, you know, and so forth. Anything could happen. Well, she had a plan, and she sent her daughter Miriam to see that this plan would happen. The basket came before the household of Pharaoh himself, and the daughter of Pharaoh was down there bathing. She went down there to bathe. And she saw this baby. She had compassion on the baby, and she drew the baby out of the water. She named him to draw, Moses. And Miriam was there. Miriam's older sister said, "Should I go get a Hebrew woman to nurse this child?" "Yes, go do that." So she goes and gets Moses' own mother. And so Moses was raised in the household of Pharaoh, knowing the ways of the Egyptians, being a prominent man in Egypt, but he was also raised by his mother, and so he knew who his God was. And he knew the plight of his people, so that by age 40, he decided, "I'm going to deliver my people." And he killed an Egyptian to kind of start this revolution. But his people didn't like that. His people rejected his own efforts to deliver them, and he fled, afraid. He fled down to Egypt. I'm going to start talking right here in a minute. He fled down to Sinai, to Mount Sinai, or Mount Sinai, however you want to pronounce that. And he lived there for 40 years. So that by age 80, he was basically a washed-up shepherd that had at one point tried to do something great, but had given up on that. But God had more plans for him. So don't give up. Don't give up. God may have more plans for you yet. Don't think that your grand days are over for accomplishing things for God. So God appeared to him. The angel of the Lord spoke to him from a burning bush and told him, "I'm going to use you to deliver my people from Pharaoh. And you're going to bring my people to a land flowing with milk and honey. And I will bring you first back down to this mountain as a sign." "Oh, I can't do it. I'm not a good speaker. How am I supposed to go and talk to Pharaoh?" God said, "You can do it." "No, I can't do it." So he gave him his brother Aaron as a helper. So Moses and Aaron head back, and they go to Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh's the most stubborn person you can imagine. And so they said, "God has said, let my people go." And at first it was just, "Let them go into a three-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices." "No, I will not do that. They're just lazy, and he makes the work harder on them." Anyway, because of his stubborn refusal to heed God's word, God sent 10 plagues upon Egypt: water to blood, frogs, lice, flies, pestilence, boils, hail, locusts, darkness, and finally death of the firstborn, to humble Egypt and to humble Pharaoh, until finally when even the firstborn of Pharaoh died with that last plague. He just said, all right, just get out. And you will never see my face again. Moses said, you're right. You will never see my face again. And so the children of Israel parted the Red Sea. You know, there's a Far Side comic where it's like supposed to be Kid Moses and he's parting, you know, the creek where somebody's trying to fish and it's these two flat walls, you know, and we might even picture that. But there may even be kids' books that are, you know, you have the parting of the Red Sea and it's just these two flat walls of water. No, God had caused an east wind to blow all night long and it separated the waters. So imagine that. That would have been just phenomenal. I don't know how well you can see it on this with our projector. You would have thought at this point, though, the Israelites would have done well. They were just delivered from captivity. This is wonderful. But they didn't do so well. They whined and complained as they went down the Sinai Peninsula and towards Sinai there. Oh, they were just whining as they went. And they complained about water, so God gave them water. They complained about food, so God gave them manna. They were attacked by their enemies at Rephidim. God delivered them. He took care of them, and now they were at Mount Sinai. And you might say, well, why didn't they just go straight to the land flowing with milk and honey? This is kind of out of the way. It's way up here. Well, they had to become God's people first. And so it was at Mount Sinai that in Exodus 19, 4 through 6, God said through Moses to the people, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And the people said, all the words that the Lord has spoken we will do. And they were ready to obey. So Moses went up the fiery mountain to receive the law and to receive the tablets. And he wasn't gone yet 40 days. And the people said, well, where is he? He's been gone a while. I guess he's not coming back. So we need to make a God to lead us. And Aaron said, okay, let's make a God. You give me all of your gold and let's do it. And so they did. And they made this golden calf. I mentioned to the kids in a recent session that we had, drill session that we had, I think it was the last one that we had, that it's a ridiculous thing to imagine worshiping a cow. You know, Mr. Jimmy has some cows out there in the pasture where we live, and I don't see how anybody could worship those things. You know, that's about the dumbest animal ever. And I mentioned that to the kids in the drill session last time, and one of them said, actually, you know, one made out of gold is even dumber because it's not alive. That's true. So not only were they worshiping a cow, but one that wasn't even alive, made out of gold. We're going to worship this and let it lead us. Oh, and God was furious. Moses was pretty upset too. And Moses came down the mountain and he had those tablets written by the finger of God, the Ten Commandments, and he threw them at the foot of the mountain and shattered them. And Mr. Waldron has made the point that perhaps the reason he did that is because the people, they had broken the covenant. So what good were the tablets? So the tablets were broken. The people were punished. Thousands were killed. A few thousand anyway. And the people repented and agreed a second time to the terms of the covenant. And so Moses went back up the mountain receiving the rest of the law and a second set of the tablets. And the tabernacle was built and set up. The law of Moses was begun. You had the priests consecrated and beginning their work. And you had the animal sacrificial system that was basically initiated with the law of Moses here. You think about this system. It's interesting. An Israelite that sinned, one of God's people that sinned, deserved to die. That's the price of sin. That's Romans 6:23 tells us the wages of sin is death. So, but the problem with that is if the sinner has to die because of his sin, then now he's dead. That's the problem with death. You're not alive anymore. You don't have a chance to then go on and obtain any kind of forgiveness. Just the price is paid for your sin. You're dead. So what God did is arranged a way where people could be forgiven of their sin without dying. Now, God demands death for sin. So instead of the sinner having to die, he arranged that an animal would die in the sinner's place. A perfect, unblemished sacrifice, a lamb. And you see in that both the justice and the mercy of God. His justice because a death has to occur, but His mercy because the death was not the death of the sinner, but the death of the substitute animal that was given in the sinner's stead. And so that's how the sinner could be reconciled back with God. And that is a shadow of what we later see in the new covenant. That's all of this is pointing to the new covenant under the law of Moses. So after around a year of being at Mount Sinai, they depart, and the Israelites depart, and go on up to the edge of the promised land, complaining and all kind of problems as they go, but okay, they've had their bumps along the road, but now they're to the land. They have their big chance now. So they send in the 12 spies, and they come back saying, the land is really fantastic, but the enemies of the land are humongous. We're like grasshoppers next to them. They were just very large people. And so, we can't do it. Now, two of the 12 spies said, yes, we can, Joshua and Caleb. But the other 10 said, no, and the rest of the congregation said, no, and, oh, let's appoint a leader to bring us back to Egypt. They wanted to go right back to captivity, which is what some people who become Christians want to do. I want to go right back into captivity where I was before I became a Christian, captivity of sin. That's foolish, foolish. Oh, I wish we had died in the wilderness. So God said, you want to die in the wilderness? I can make arrangements for that. I'll just let you die in the wilderness. So, he let them die in the wilderness. Well, what about our children? Oh, don't worry about them. They'll be the ones that get to enter my land, your children. So all that generation died, the older generation. And for 40 years, they just lived out in the wilderness. Toward the end of that 40 years, the children of these people who died in the wilderness were now pretty much ready to enter the land. And they traveled south and east around the Dead Sea and around Moab and up to the east side of the Jordan River. Now, the land of Israel, the land of flowing with milk and honey, was here on the west side. But they were over here on the east side at this point, and they defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan. I just like the name Og. I mean, if you had the name Og, you'd have to be a pretty tough fella. Og had an iron bedstead that was 13 feet long and 6.5 feet wide. He was a big dude. He was big. And they defeated Og, king of Bashan, and Sihon, king of the Amorites, and their armies. The point is, this generation of Israelites were not afraid of giants. Their parents were afraid of these large people, but not this generation. And after defeating the enemies on the east side of the Jordan, they then crossed the Jordan on dry ground in time of flood, which was miraculous. And under the leadership of Joshua, they entered into the land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey. Moses was not allowed to enter. He died at 120 years old on the top of Mount Nebo, being allowed to view the land but not enter it because he had sinned in the wilderness. So Joshua, one of the original 12 spies, takes over as leader. And they go in and they conquer this territory and all the enemies in the land. And one side of us says, you know, that's not nice to go and kill people. Well, no. But you have to understand, God had had patience with the people in this land. You could sum them up as calling them the Amorites or the Canaanites. And at this point, he had it up to here. The iniquity of the Amorite was now full, and he was done. He was ready to wipe them off of the map. And so he used his people Israel as a tool to rid the land of the wickedness, to get rid of these wicked people. So, that's what happened. And they took the land. And so, at this point, we see not only has a nation come from Abraham, but now they have, the descendants of Abraham have inherited the land. And that promise was fulfilled. Joshua 21, verse 43 is one of the verses. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua. Judges 2 and verse 7. But then Judges 2 and verse 10 says, all that generation were also gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. And you remember Mr. Waldron preached about, you know, Deuteronomy 6 and the importance of teaching your children diligently the Word of God. So why was there at this time, after Joshua, why was there a generation who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which he had done? Because the parents were not teaching their children. And if we don't teach our children, that's exactly what will happen. We'll have a generation that does not know the Lord. And this is a very dark time following this invasion and conquest, because the next period is the period of the judges. The word for judge just means deliverer. So these were deliverers to save their people out of all the trouble they were getting in because of their sin. And this just kept happening. It was a vicious cycle throughout this 350-year time of the judges. The last judge was Samuel. And in the days of Samuel, the people came to him and said, "You are old, and your sons do not follow in your ways, and we don't want judges anymore. We want a king. That's what we want." And boy, Samuel felt rejected. And God told him, "They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me and my plan for them." And so, they want a king? All right. God will give them a king. Now, that's one of the things we see in the Bible. Sometimes God just gives you what you want, but it's not what you really need, and it doesn't end up being good for you. So he gives them what they want. Saul, he was tall, he was handsome, he'll be our ruler. Well, he was also idiotic, and he was an imbecile, and he was a failure as a king. And so God replaced him with David. Now, Saul also was of the wrong tribe. Jacob prophesied in Genesis 49 and verse 10, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin, but David was of the tribe of Judah. And eventually that same one that would crush Satan's head, who is named Shiloh in Genesis 49:10, he would also be of the tribe of Judah, and he would be king forever. But I'll get to that later. So David was a man after God's own heart. He was a good man. He had a lot of sin, but he always repented and turned back to God when he sinned. Because David was a good man, God promised to him in 2 Samuel 7 and verses 12 and 13. He said, "When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you, who will come forth from you, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." Now you say, well, was that Solomon? Well, there's a partial fulfillment there, but Solomon proved to be a failure as well. And so ultimately that could not be fulfilled in Solomon, though Solomon did build a house, a temple for God. There would be one to come later. And this is the only way the forever part could be fulfilled in that passage. It had to be a forever king. It had to be a king who would reign forever and who would build a temple. We are the temple, the people of God. So David made, he wrote most of the Psalms, and he made some prophecies in those Psalms regarding the one that was to come. In the 22nd Psalm, for example, "For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. They look, they stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." So 700 years before, no, that's 1,000 years before Christ came. After David, we have Solomon, who did not use his wisdom as he should. He did build a house for the Lord, but he also built houses for the idols. And because of his idolatry, the Lord told him, "The kingdom's going to be divided in the days of your son." And so it was. The kingdom divides north and south. You had Israel in the north and Judah in the south. This situation went on for 200 years. These two kingdoms coexisted. The northern kingdom was more wicked than the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom clung to idolatry, and this is really from the influence of Solomon that we see all this idolatry is going to go on. The northern kingdom clung to idolatry and never turned away from it. The southern kingdom of Judah had some good kings and some righteousness. So the northern kingdom was taken away first. God took them out of the land and took them into Assyrian captivity. Judah was left in the land for 135 years longer. And you say, well, how did that happen? And you look at this map and you see all that green territory. That is the territory of Assyria. I mean, they're just mowing down everything in their path. And then here's this tiny pink dot on that map, Judah. Well, couldn't this big nation take Judah? Well, sure, they could have. So how did Judah defend itself? By military power? There's no way. There's no historical way that could have happened. The only way it happened is God killed 185,000 Assyrians in one night in their sleep. And God preserved his people for 135 years longer than the northern kingdom existed. So after that period of time, the southern kingdom had also had much idolatry. So God was done with Judah as well and took them into Babylonian captivity. This captivity, as Jeremiah prophesied in Jeremiah chapter 25 and in Jeremiah chapter 20, it lasted for 70 years. We have the stories of Daniel and Ezekiel. When you think of Daniel and the lion's den, do you picture a 90-year-old man? Or 80, some, probably at least in his mid-80s or more? He was old. The writing on the wall, Daniel was a very elderly man at that time. Because his life spans this 70 years of captivity. Well, the children of Israel were given the opportunity under the Persian king Cyrus to return to the land. And you would think a lot of them would have done it, but only 50,000 did. That's a pretty small number considering all that were in captivity. So 50,000 decided, okay, we want to go back. We want to serve the Lord. And they sort of did. They rebuilt the temple eventually. They rebuilt the walls of the city and rebuilt the city itself even later. But they did not rebuild their hearts. They returned to the land, but they did not return to the Lord. And so God, through the last writing prophet of the Old Testament, Malachi, basically told the people, you have failed. And God had nothing more to say to them. And so he did not reveal anything through his prophets. For 400 years, we call these the years of silence, where God did not have any more to be written in his Old Testament, but it was to be expected that the messenger of the covenant was coming. Malachi 3 and verse 1, the second half of that verse. The messenger of the covenant. There was going to be a new covenant. And so that messenger would be Jesus, who was preceded by John the Baptizer, preparing the way for him. Jesus came and grew up and began his ministry. This is the Son of God. And in his ministry, he proved through his not only his miracles, but also through his teaching, that he was indeed the Son of God. He showed what it meant to reach out to people that nobody else would. He proved his enemies wrong with irrefutable arguments. He demonstrated what it meant to be truly dedicated to the Father with a personal relationship and not just outward ceremony. He showed what it meant to have compassion and to forgive people that nobody else would even blink at. He patiently and lovingly guided his disciples as their faith slowly grew. And he showed us the glory of the Father. He came to his own, and his own received him not, and put him on a cross. This is one through whom the worlds were made. He was put on a cross. That wood is wood that he made. The iron that was in those nails was brought from the earth, and that was iron that he made. He was pinned up on this cross. The thorns on his head, he made those thorns. The people that scoffed at him and that hung him up on a cross like a piece of meat, he made those people. We have no idea what humility means. until we look at the Son of God. He became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. In His death, we see the fulfillment of what was shadowed back in the law of Moses with the animal sacrificial system. You and I, when we sin, we deserve to die. That's what we deserve. That would be just if God just killed us for our sin. But our God is a God of mercy. And so God has made a way that we can be forgiven without dying because somebody died for us. And we die with Him. We die through Him. And in so doing, in that symbolic death of our own, which is actually Christ's death, our sins are dealt with. And we die by repenting of our sin and by being buried in the waters of baptism and rising to walk in newness of life. And thus we can be sanctified. We can be made whole. Christ died and was buried. And on the third day, He was risen from the dead. Therefore, God has also highly exalted Him and given Him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of those in heaven and of those on earth and of those under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. God put all things in subjection under His feet, that He might be head over all things to the church, which is the fullness of Him who filleth all in all. Christ ascended to heaven to sit down at the right hand of God. Jesus is the offspring foretold in the Old Testament. This is the descendant of David, of the tribe of Judah, who is on the throne of David now. This is King Jesus, Messiah, the anointed. The whole idea of that is kingship. He's the king. He is the seed of Abraham, through whom all the world is blessed, because now they have the offer of salvation. And He is the seed of woman. And uniquely through woman, because He had no earthly father, He is the seed of woman who dealt the crushing blow to Satan's head and rendered powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil, Hebrews 2 and verse 14. Brethren, if that's not powerful, the plan of God, then I don't know what is. Not only did Christ die to save mankind, He also died to establish His church and to begin a new covenant. And so the early church began. In the book of Acts, we see the beginning of the carrying out of the Great Commission. The apostles went to take the gospel to the whole known world. He that believes and is baptized will be saved. He that disbelieves shall be condemned. That repentance would be proclaimed in His name to all the nations, beginning from Jerusalem. And that commission is to be continued to be carried out today. The Bible begins with paradise and ends with paradise. Have you ever thought about that? That's the two bookends of the Bible. We see in the paradise of Eden a river that ran through the garden, the tree of life, no pain, no death, no sin. And in the paradise of heaven, there is a river of water of life that runs through it, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. And on either side of the river, there is the tree of life, and its leaves are for the healing of the nations. There is no pain. There are no tears. There is no death. There are no sinners and no sin there. And there's no need of the sun or of the moon, because God will illumine heaven. You won't have to wonder where He is either, because He is the light in which we will exist and bask. It's a beautiful thought. The Bible is the story of, as they say, the scheme of man's redemption. But even more than that, I don't know if I could say more than that, but there's another way to look at it too. Not only is it a plan to redeem man, but it's also a plan to bring back paradise, like it originally was, but even grander. It's a beautiful thought. You fit into this plan. You know, it's not, well, I read the Bible and, well, it's done. Well, it's not over until the last enemy is conquered, and that is death. And so until Christ comes back, it's not over. This is still going. God did a lot of work for us in revealing all of this and in putting all of this into place. And so we can fit into that plan if we choose to do it. We can do it. How would you sum up the Bible? We could have some cute little saying like the B-I-B-L-E, basic information before leaving Earth, or something like that. But I like what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 2, where he said, "For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified." Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that Paul just went to Corinth and said, "Okay, you Corinthians, you Corinthian Christians, Jesus died on the cross, and you need to know that"? Is that all he said? Well, no. But the cross of Christ, properly defined, explains everything. In a sense, every page of the Bible tells us something about the crucified Christ, and therefore something about us, His crucified disciples. It's all from the very beginning. It's a beautiful thing. So won't you become a part of this plan today? Won't you do what Jesus said, coming and believing in the Son of God, this King, the Messiah, the Christ, repenting of your sins and being baptized? Then you can have hope of going to that paradise and living eternally without any pain or death or fear. That's your choice. The other alternative is not a pleasant one. It's an eternity of the fires of hell. It's lonely. It's weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's absolute separation from anything that is good and holy and pure and loving. It's hell, is what it is. So it really is your choice. And you can leave this morning having the hope of eternal salvation. Won't you submit your life to Jesus today as we stand and sing the song of invitation?